call the Natural Resource Subcommittee of Ways and Means to order and open the public hearing on Senate Bill 5527, Division of State Lands. And we were trying to wait till we got some House members here, but I understand that their floor session went late, so we just as well get started. Sue McGlashan, would you like to lay it out for us today?
Sure. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair and subcommittee member, I provided some background information for you, similar to what you've seen on other agency budgets that you considered. And I won't go through this in detail because I think everything that I provided here is going to be covered in one way or another by the agency or by the Department of Administrative Services Budget and Management Division. But I just draw your attention to behind the orientation and background sheet I have provided for you, kind of a snapshot of what the agency does and the budget size, revenue sources, and the budget drivers, and that's front and back. And then I've also provided the more detailed analysis of the agency's budget, similar to what you've seen, again, on other state agencies. The division has provided for you their presentation document, which is this smaller binder that's got the black and white print on the front, and they'll be using that for their presentation. And then you also have a copy of the detailed governor's balance budget, and that's the one that has the yellow cover. So unless there are any questions of me.
So where's the audit report?
Mr. Chair, the audit report for this agency in the governor's balance budget binder, that is in behind tab 10, you'll see a copy of that audit report. And they do have a policy package in their budget that's tied to that audit report, so this will get some discussion.
10 is affirmative action.
I'm sorry, oh, it's 10. I'm sorry, 10.
Oh, well, I'm in the wrong book.
Okay.
Yeah. Said governor.
Are Dukes, any other questions?
Okay. I know they'll cover this. I was just so shocked when I saw it, and I assume I'm thinking the wrong thing. Common School Fund programs, that's not the total amount in the Common School Fund, right?
Senator Dukes, that's correct. That is just the expenditure limitation, and in this case it also includes some non-limited expenditures for the division. It's not the balance in the Common School Fund
good.
Itself.
I was going to say, we cut it in half? Thank you.
Okay, ma'am.
There is a handout on our PowerPoint presentation that I believe is in your binder under tab 1.
Got it.
Okay. For the record, my name is Ann Hannes. I'm the Director of the Division of State Lands. Before I start my presentation, I'd like to introduce some of my staff that is here today. Steve Purchase, who is Assistant Director in Charge of Field Operations. Jeanette Holman, who is Assistant Director in Charge of Finance and Administration. John Lilly, Assistant Director in Charge of Policy and Planning. And Cindy Wickham, who is my Fiscal Manager. And so I think that they'll be able to answer questions that I can't, and I may be calling on them from time to time to assist in providing any answers to your questions. So let me just start with the presentation, if it'll go. First part is why the agency exists, and this is trying to answer the questions that were provided to us. Our mission is to ensure a legacy for Oregonians in their public schools through sound stewardship of lands, wetlands, waterways, unclaimed property, estates, and the Common School Fund. What unites us is the Common School Fund. We have a diverse set of agency programs with distinct functions that include regulatory, proprietary, which is our land management, administrative, and fiscal. And again, the common denominator is the link to the Common School Fund. Our overall mandates come from are both constitutional and statutory. The Constitution includes language referencing the Common School Fund. because at the time of statehood, that's when Oregon received two sections out of every township. Starting with the state of Ohio, these two sections were given for the benefit of schools as an endowment for those schools. And we still have some of those lands remaining, and the Constitution defines how that land should be managed and spent. It also deals with estates of people who die without wills or heirs. Our statutory mandates include the uniform disposition of unclaimed property, estates, those are people that die without wills or, and heirs, the removal fill law, wetlands policy, state lands management, the natural heritage program, and the South Slough National Estuary Reserve.
Technical difficulties, you're on.
Yeah. The purpose why DSL exists is that we're the administrative arm of the state land board, which consists of the governor, the treasurer, and the secretary of state. We manage common school fund assets. This includes, as I mentioned, the lands and waterways granted at statehood in 1859. It also includes some lands from an 1841 Act of Congress, the swamp lands, and also unclaimed property and estates without heirs or wills. We protect state waterways and wetlands. We also manage the South Slough National Estuary Reserve and provide support to the Natural Heritage Program. This map shows where a lot of our lands are. Probably, I'm just going to get up here, but the largest chunks we have are the Elliott State Forest, which you're familiar with, some scattered tracts up in the coastal area, but by far the largest amount of tracts of land that we own are in eastern Oregon here in rangeland. And in addition to that, the beds and banks of navigable rivers and waterways.
And could I ask you to get us a full sheet of that map? The one we have here is too small to read.
Would you like a small, or we can get you a large version?
Well, I think something that would fit in the book, but just be a full sheet. Right. Okay. Now it's a half sheet. And if you could do it in color, that'd be really good.
We could do that. Great. And just in terms of acreage for land, we manage 133,000 acres of forest land, 630,000 acres of range land, 200 acres of commercial and industrial lands for a total of 770,000 uplands. And we also have 800,000 in terms of submerged submersible lands in the territorial seas, 4,800 acres at South Slough, and then 2 million acres of mineral rights that we manage. This diagram shows how the Common School Fund works. On the upper left is the constitutional revenue that comes in. According to the actuals for 9901, there was about 46 million dollars coming in constitutional revenue. Statutory revenue includes the waterway leases, and that's about $8 million. And then unclaimed property. Unclaimed property is kind of unusual in that the state holds that money in trust, so we never really hold title to that money in the unclaimed property. But while it's in the common school fund, we earn interest and investment earnings off of that, and that benefits the schools. But we hold those until they're claimed by rightful owners. And we get
so,
about...
So, and how does that work if they're never claimed? You never find a...
Then it continues to stay in the common school fund. And so an heir, for example, if it were your grandfather's or great-grandfather's, and you were the heir, you could claim that.
So there's no time statute of limitation or anything?
No, there's not. As opposed to on the estates, there's a 10-year escheat period. Mr. Chairman.
Yes, Representative Johnson.
I just want to make sure that I understand. That's all in terms of conversion to cash. I mean, we're talking all cash?
Eventually it's all cash. We get it in a number of different forms. We get cash, like an unclaimed payroll check.
Mm-hmm.
We also get safety deposit box contents, and sometime I'd invite you to come to our vault and see what we get, as well as when we have an auction. We're hoping to have an auction this spring. But it ranges from coins to jewelry to certificates to false teeth. I mean, we wouldn't believe some of the stuff that we get in our boxes. And then we auction that off. We also get unclaimed, like mutual funds and stocks as well, that we sell those, and it goes into the common school fund.
Well, Mr. Chair, when the safety deposit box gets opened and inside is the 27-carat cashmere sapphire that's headed off to auction, how do you assure that you're getting maximum value?
Chair Mesley, Representative Johnson, that's a real good question, because that was an issue when I first became director, that we wanted to make sure that we were getting the maximum value for that. Now we've put into place a new set of procedures so that we're going to try to get appraisals or assessments of what value we can expect for that, and then we would then provide instructions to the auctioneer about what kind of values we want to get for that. But before that, there had not been those kind of procedures in place.
And follow, Mr. Chair. Have you gotten any dramatic saves where, in some case, somebody may have thought their piece of jewelry was paste and it turns out to be? And is your system demonstrating that it's working?
Senator Mezzo, Representative Johnson, we're putting into place now. This is the first auction we're going to have since we've had that, and we're currently going through and looking at the kind of jewelry and the coins that we have to try to decide what the value of it is. But one of the things that was of concern, one of the first auctions I went to, is that there was some jewelry there that someone came up was very proud that they had purchased that was far less than what it was worth, and that was one of the reasons why we decided that we needed to take a much harder look at what our procedures were, and that had been sold several years before I became director.
One more thought. I also think the kind of publicity that surrounds the auctions. I know that in the newspapers, routinely, there are auctions that are well attended with spirited bidding, and I don't know what you do to try to let folks know that there are state auctions and the magnitude of the items that they could expect to find at a state auction.
Chairman Mesley, Senator or Representative Johnson, will be publicizing them as much as we possibly can, as well as working with an auctioneer who will publicize them as well. The last auction we held was in Albany, and we held it at the fairgrounds, and we got pretty good attendance. I'm hoping we get real good attendance this time.
Let me expand that a little bit. And you have these items appraised, and then you put a minimum bid on?
Senator Mesley, that's what we intend to do. And I think what we'll have is we're probably, Jeanette and I were talking and getting ready for this next auction, is that we would hire like a jeweler to come in and look at the different pieces we have and to try to separate out which ones were of high value, try to, you know, and look at which, like diamond rings are zirconium and which ones are truly, you know, high value diamonds. Coins are a little bit easier to figure out because you can look in various books to see, you know, what those values of coins are. Jewelry is a little more difficult.
And you have a live auction or eBay, or what kind of auction do you use?
We would be doing a live auction with an auctioneer, although one of the bills that we have in, based on a recommendation that we got from the Secretary of State, would allow us for unusual items to be able to use eBay or some other methods of auctioning, so we can try to make sure that we get the highest value possible.
I know the state surplus and the feds sell, I think, almost all their surplus property now through eBay. And mm-hmm. I have fun, watch a lot of that stuff, and it's amazing how much some of that
It's, you know,
that goes for it. I won't categorize it what I think of it, but it's seems like it's over market.
It's amazing the kind of items that we get. It's really fascinating.
Representative Johnson?
I guess this exchange just causes me to think of one more thing. As we're combing through budgets looking for duplications, it seems to me that there must be quite a bit of time and energy put into mounting an auction. And now that DAS was in here bragging about their expertise in working with eBay and that they're one of the largest sellers, why do you have two separate auction departments? Could legislation be introduced to change the way that you dispose of your unclaimed property so we've only got one set of experts doing it instead of it occurring in two different places?
If I understand, I'll ask Jeanette to address this too, because trust properties is under her. We've worked with DAS on some of the things that we have, but we also have some unique types of items that we're working with, you know, as opposed to like state equipment, where we're working with jewelry and coins and the such. But
selling it, Mr. Chair, it shouldn't matter. If you've got expertise developed in one place, they're selling airplanes, they're selling all sorts of stuff.
That's a lot of jewelry.
Representative Chair Mosley, Representative Johnson. For the record, I'm Jeanette Holman, Assistant Director for Finance and Administration. One of the things the bill would do would allow us to use the eBay, and we would probably not do it ourselves. We would probably have DES do it for us because we don't have the expertise. They have somebody full-time running the eBay auction for them, and it wouldn't make sense for us to do it. So I'm not sure if we get the bill passed that allows us the extra flexibility. We have talked to them some about our auctions, and they're real different from what they do, so they didn't feel like they had the expertise to do it. Much of our advice comes from the auctioneers. They have pretty broad expertise. The auctioneer we've been working with recently is less comfortable with doing appraisals of jewelry, so that's something we would probably have appraised out. But
maybe I'm working this too hard. I still haven't heard the answer that says, sure, we could explore putting it in one place. I feel like there's a real heavy pushback here, and I'm just trying to understand why.
I think what we're saying is that we're looking at, you know, where we can get, you know, the best way to get the top dollar for the, you know, the types of items we have. In some cases, it really does make sense for DAS to take over and help us out with, like, eBay-related items. In other cases, we contract directly with an auctioneer who has expertise in working on jewelry and things like that. So we'd be open to trying to explore ways that we can make this more efficient and, you know, where the best expertise is.
Thank you.
And I didn't get a dollar figure for how much the interest on the reclaimed property generates for you.
I believe revenue coming in from unclaimed property dividends are about $800,000, roughly $800,000 a year. But again, that fluctuates depending on how well the portfolio of stocks is doing.
And how many people die and all those things?
Well, for unclaimed property, that's more that's on the statutory side, and those are truly unclaimed. The estates are actually considered constitutional revenue because it is listed in the Constitution. And that one does, of course, fluctuate because it depends on how business is doing that way. And then, so what happens then with the revenues flow into the Common School Fund principal, and as of February 28th, it stood at $624 million. It's fluctuated over the last 2 years between $600 to $800 million. Unfortunately, it's at the lower end because of how the stock market's been doing. Our portfolio for the Common School Fund is invested about 70% in equities. And as a result, it's really subject to the swings of the market. Anyway, the earnings from the Common School Fund flow out, and then net of constitutional expenses that's distributed to schools. For the biennium, those distributions have ranged between $31 million and $76 million, and that is subject to the land board's distribution policy, which is a sliding scale policy.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, Representative Morgan.
There's an equation, I believe, based on the earnings of the fund that governs the distribution. Is it?
Senator Messerly, Representative Morgan, the sliding scale formula is based on the year-over-year change in the size of the fund itself. So up to about 5% change in the value of the fund, there's a minimum distribution of 2% of the fund that's sent out to schools, and after that it's a sliding scale.
What happens if the fund is actually in losing money rather than gaining money?
Senator Messerly, Representative Morgan, the land board has a 2% minimum. So there's kind of a floor.
So they have to disperse 2% of it.
Right. Well, except based on Attorney General advice that we got, we can really only distribute as much as flow out of the earnings. So actually, you know, one of the issues that the land board's going to be dealing with is looking at, you know, how can we try to stabilize and increase distributions over time, given that wanting to achieve that 2% minimum and even trying to see if we can increase it over time.
So I'm kind of confused by what I'm hearing you say, that there is a new attorney general's opinion saying that they can only distribute from earnings. Is it?
Senator Messerly, Representative Morgan, it's not new. It was clarified last year when the governor sought advice about what could be distributed from the Common School Fund, when there were debates going on about what tapping the Common School Fund to meet budget needs. And in that, the Attorney General defined what's in the Common School Fund, but also said that we could distribute only the earnings from the fund to schools. And that was clarifying and emphasizing what we had known before.
But earnings in that case means what goes in and what's been earned off of that over time, not just in a discrete time frame?
Earnings are defined as what you get in a fiscal period. So just like, you know, when you do it for your taxes, what you earn from your mutual funds might be the capital gains as well as the dividends and as well as an interest from bonds. It's those that the interest earnings off of the investments plus the dividends as well. So, for example, if you have a timber sale on the Elliott State Forest, the revenue from the timber sale goes into the Common School Fund. That money from the timber sale stays in the corpus, and then it's the earnings generated off of money that's generated from our lands that then comes out. So the corpus then, the idea is that it will grow over time.
So then, just to clarify in my mind, you have inside of this box called the Common School Trust Fund, you've got money that actually was in there because timber was sold or where, you know, the other revenue sources that come in there. That money was invested over the 90s and generated another pile of money. So the 2% minimum disbursement can come out of that whole pile of money that's earnings?
Senator Messerly, Representative Morgan, it can only come out of the earnings itself. It cannot come out of the original principal.
Yeah, okay. But it doesn't have to be like the earnings in the previous biennium or anything like that. It can be the whole of the earnings of the fund over time.
No, it can only be within the fiscal period, so within a one-year fiscal period or within a biennial fiscal period.
Well, then wouldn't it be true if you're in a place that we're in right now where there is virtually no growth in the fund because of earnings, that there couldn't be a disbursement?
Senator Messerly, Representative Morgan, no, there's still earnings that are generated. What the problem is we're not getting any capital gains. And so we're still getting money from dividends from the stocks as well as interest from the bonds.
But that must be a hugely diminished amount of returns.
Senator Mesley, Representative Morgan, that's correct, and that's why the distributions have fluctuated from a high of $76 million when the stock market was so high to, in the last 2 years, it's at $31
million. Do you anticipate how much it will be for 2003-2005?
I'm saying this off the top of my head. I think it's about $33 million, I think, for next biennium. And that is in the unlimited category of expenditures, and so that if we end up having a great boom in the stock market in the next year, maybe we'll be able to send out more. But it's subject to how well the market's doing.
And is there discussions with the board, land board, or within your department of leveling that out, taking an average, what you think will be an average earnings for us?
Senator Mesley, very much so. Over the last year, we've been trying to search for different ways that we could do that, ranging from exploring should we change the portfolio mix so that maybe instead of 70% stocks, do we go to 50% stocks? We've had an analysis done by Russell Company that the treasurer had commissioned to look at that. We've also been looking at ways that we can try to stabilize them more. Because we're limited to the earnings, you can't just do like a 3 to 5 year moving average. It still would have to be predicated on what the earnings flow is coming out of the fund. And the other thing that is being explored by the land board at next week's is moving some of the constitutional expenses to come out of the constitutional revenue flow, similar to how we do with the statutory, so that would free up more money to go out to schools. But the downside, I mean, each one kind of has its pros and cons. The downside of doing that is that it would probably diminish the long-term balance of the common school fund by 1 to 2% over time. So we're trying to weigh out which one from a policy standpoint, and given the goals of trying to increase and stabilize distributions, and then weighing out the impact on current and future generations of kids, what that would mean.
Just a comment. That's a very fine science. The banks do that, you know, whether they invest in bonds or all the different types of funds and processes, stocks or whatever, try to keep a level income for the portfolio and their cash flow. So I would think that's a real opportunity for the state. But it's also some risk as well, unless you really know what you're doing. And I was going to, you haven't explained the different types of expenses.
The what?
The different types of expenses. You've got the revenue.
Oh, the different types of expenses. On the constitutional expenses, that includes money, and probably the largest amount goes to the Department of Forestry because they're under contract to us to manage forest land. So $8 to $9 million goes out to the Department of Forestry for management of our lands. State lands operations are about $4 to $5 million of that. And those are probably the largest chunks of that constitutional expenses. In terms of statutory expenses, that includes money for management of the waterway program. That also pays for unclaimed property and the removal fill program, and then there are expenses also for fiscal management and IT are divided between the constitutional and statutory.
And then you've got capital improvement and maintenance.
Correct. Capital improvement and maintenance monies that includes money in there for doing repairs, major repairs to our building. DSL owns, or the land board, Common School Fund owns the DSL building that's north of the employment building, and we get also rents from that building from our tenants, Economic Development and OWEB, for example, are in that building. But also that capital improvement money has been used to pay for range rehabilitation and fire expenses that we've had in the past, for example, in the past couple years.
Where does your administration money come out of?
It comes out of the constitutional expenses, and then also some comes out of the statutory expenses. My salary, if that's what you're asking, comes out of the constitutional expenses.
Well, not just yours, but the whole department for all your operating expenses. Okay, and that's by statute then?
The statutory expenses are by statute, yes.
But I mean, all of your administrative expenses are set up, part of it comes from statutes and part of it comes out of the Constitution, or how does that work?
Yes, that's correct.
Be interesting to see a summary of that. Maybe it'd take volumes to do that, but I'm not looking for that at all. But
we can get you that information.
Representative Morgan?
It seems to me, when I've heard this budget before, that there is a visual, kind of a spreadsheet-type thing that details. I mean, it's like this, except it's not so graphic, but it has some more information about what comes in and what goes out.
Senator Mesley, Representative Morgan, we did have a more detailed diagram, and many found that it was really difficult to follow because it was all these little boxes with arrows and everything around. We can provide you with all the, you know, what dollar amounts that make up each of those different sources, and we provide that. Actually, it's in your book now,
but
that I think
yeah,
about it.
Yeah, it's just giving me the it's in your book signal here.
go ahead.
Where are you at?
In the budget document?
Mm-hmm. It's this
right here.
What page?
3-1. So if you look in the actual budget document, here's actually the same one, but has all the detail next to it. And then, yeah, right, you can turn it over and it'll tell you exactly what's in each area. We just found this a whole lot easier to provide to people to understand what comes in and goes out of the Common School Fund.
Okay. Interesting.
Yes, Senator Dukes.
The forestry expenses to contract with the Department of Forestry. I mean, sales are down. I'm just trying to get a feel for how does what we pay them compare with what we get out of it.
That's a great question because. Senator Mezzo, Senator Dukes, we just recently commissioned a study that John Buter completed. He's a prominent forestry consultant, and it's going to be presented to the land board at their land board meeting next week. And he concluded, because what we asked him is, and there had been concerns raised because we're going to be seeing forestry revenues fall from about $42 million down to, I think, around $26 million in the next biennium, and a lot of that is due to marbled murrelets and ESA concerns, particularly on the Elliott State Forest and some of the other forest lands that are managed. So we asked him to look at how our costs...
What are they going to be at? They're going to go from 42 to what?
42 to about, I think, 26.
And 26 are the expenses going to stay at 8.6?
That's correct. So that
I'm asking, yeah.
That raised concerns, and that was also a concern that the Treasurer and Secretary of State brought up on the land board. So we commissioned the study by John Buter, and he just issued his report within the last month. I can get you a copy of that.
I'd like to see that, and I guess I'd also like to know. I know that the Elliott is getting more and more tied up. It has a number of owls in it, and now somebody's telling me don't worry about the owls anymore, it's the marble murrelet.
It's the marble murrelet that we're most concerned about.
I was wondering, since you started out managing for fiduciary, benefit to the common school fund, and if we reach a point where we're managing for the critters, what is our obligation? Is there a statutory obligation? Is there a constitutional obligation, or is it just whatever the land board should decide we're going to do?
Senator Meserly, Senator Dukes, there was actually, I think, Attorney General opinion about that, particularly about the spotted owls. Like any other private landowner, we need to comply with the Federal Endangered Species Act. One of the reasons why we're trying hard to get a habitat conservation plan for the Elliott is to provide us with more certainty, because every time right now the HCP for murrelets has expired, and every time we find a murrelet, it sets aside more land to try to deal with those take guidelines. So we've got to find another way out, or it's going to end up eroding the amount of revenue we're going to receive over time. The land board has, some latitude in terms of how it manages to maximize revenues over time consistent with sound stewardship in the Constitution. But we still have to comply with the ESA. In John Buter's report, he does a really good job of showing what the impact of marble murrelets is meaning to the Elliott State Forest, and why an HCP is important, and why other land managers, public and private, that have gotten an HCP have found that that's one way to provide some certainty and assurance over time that they can continue to operate.
I was just wondering, if, say, another 2,000 murrelets are found in the next year, if there's a point at which we can stop paying state forestry and just say, we'll come back in a couple of years and check and see if they're still here. Is there some law or piece of the Constitution that would require us to go in and be sound stewards? The County Forest Trust lands, I understand. The constitutional stuff, I don't get quite as well.
Senator Meserly, Senator Dukes, I think under the fiduciary responsibility, the trust responsibility the land board has, they can't just set aside the Elliott for a park or a wilderness area because it wouldn't...
And I wasn't really suggesting that.
I'm just saying that we couldn't just, I don't think, just kind of walk away and say we're giving it all to the murrelet.
But we could perhaps say that the cost of extraction is higher than the cost of not extracting, and so therefore for the next couple of years we're going to monitor, but we're not going to be out there actively managing a forest.
But then, Senator Dukes, wouldn't the net result of that be to bring the revenue contribution to a close and the expense side to a close? And wouldn't you just be...
Well, what I'm saying is, if the expense side is higher than the contribution side, can they get to a point where they say, now hang on here, it's costing us more to try to get timber out than we're getting out of it, and so let's monitor it as opposed to continue. I guess I'm just wondering if how tied in are we to having to have the state forestry manage that, even if we get to a point where we don't get anything out of it. Because there's whole other issues out there, and I don't know whether they have to deal with those whole other issues of good stewardship, and I'm not suggesting that
they shut down the Elliott State Forest
by any stretch. I'm just wondering. $8 million is a lot of money.
Well, and especially when you're matching it off against $26 million in revenue, and I'm not sure that if you did get to, if the revenue fell almost in half, if there wouldn't also be some concurrent diminishment in the expenses.
You'd like to think, wouldn't you?
Well, at least a bit.
And at the same time, the birds are showing up more often than the loggers, apparently.
I think I'm losing control here.
We've been losing.
What I'll do is we'll get you copies of this study that John Buter did. The other reason why the revenues are going down is because stumpage prices have also fallen. So it's been a combination of the marble muralet and the stumpage prices combined. He does conclude that in looking at the Oregon Department of Forestry's management costs with similar forests owned by others, and he looked at private and public, that their management costs were reasonable.
But still, Mr. Chair, I think it does beg the question of where's the floor here? I mean, if we're going to erode almost half of the dollars out of the harvest side of this, how much worse can it get than that?
I think there are a lot of issues at stake here. Number one, I'm surprised that some school district hasn't gone to court over this issue, number one. Number two, I question, maybe you can answer this for me, Ann. Even though the Department of Forestry manages the forest, do they absorb all the liability in case of a forest fire or whatever, or do you share that?
Senator Messer, the costs that we have, that we pay to the Department of Forestry also are the costs connected with our share of fire expenses.
So if you have a major event, they don't come back to the fund and say, hey, we need some more help here. We've gone over our limit or deductible or whatever.
Not for, you know, what they're managing for us. Because, you know, we're just like, you know, others that pay to the Department of Forestry in terms of for fire costs.
And I just have to say, I don't think there's ever a point where you could say there's no cost here at all, because we all know that to own property, whether you have any income or not, costs money. Just the management, the liabilities, the legal aspects, the neighborly disputes, and everything else that goes with it. But I think it's the question is proper that let's define that better, what kind of service we're getting for the expense.
My hope is that what we're seeing now is kind of more the bottom, and that with an HCP in place, we're hoping that that's going to go up as well as when stumpage prices go up again.
Which is my understanding that sustainably we can potentially cut 80 million feet a year, but with the HCP we're only allowed to cut 20 million per year.
I'm not sure it's as high as 80. I'm thinking it's more like maybe 50, and we're still working on the HCP to know exactly how much that will be. And it would be, I think, good. I think you're going to have the budget from forestry coming up within the next week or so. And so you could ask them some of the more specific questions as well.
I got one question. Senator, I'll defer to the good senator.
Mostly just a comment. If Mr. Buter is relying on state forestry's cost for county forest trust lands to judge whether or not their charges to you are reasonable, don't use that as a scale, because the statutes give state forestry 25-35% of whatever the receipts are off the county forest trust lands to use for management. That's not necessarily based on cost, it's based on the statute. So I think we've grown into that percentage. And
Senator Messerly, Senator Dukes, what he compared them to was to Washington DNR and the average of four industrial timber owners in Western Oregon and Washington.
The last piece I would pay attention to.
Okay.
Good.
Is that it,
Morgan?
Thank you.
Another one.
This is hugely concerning to me because we're in a place where, because of the declining revenue in the general fund, the funding going into K-12 is going to be very diminished than it was before. And what I'm really curious about is, as a policy position, where the governor is on this. And I'm wondering, you know, as your boss, what direction is he giving you in terms of trying to maximize the returns from the forest land to the common school funder, if you are getting any direction from him in which way you should go in this issue?
Senator Messerly, Representative Morgan, Well, one, I think I know where Jim Brown stands, having worked with him for so long. But I'd almost like to talk with you after the land board meets next week, because they will have they will be presented with this by John Buter, and I've not had any discussion with the governor on this issue in particular, but part of having this study go before them is to start having the land board thinking about the not only the costs and the revenues, but also the habitat conservation plan and the Elliott management plan that are under development, because they're going to have to come to the land board for approval.
Well, and I think that there are even more fundamental policy issues about the nature of the constitutional mandates that are on the land, and how the states being able to fulfill those mandates, given the Endangered Species Act and the Clean Water Act overlays on it. And, I mean, it is really frustrating to have our ability to fund our schools be hamstrung by the federal government.
Senator, I'm not disagree. I mean, it is frustrating because this is, you know, a substantial share of revenues coming into the Common School Fund, and that's why we try to watch it pretty carefully.
Well, and I would hope, rather than, you know, a discussion in the land board about how many limbs will we cut off the baby here and hand them over to the federal government, that there'll be a more fundamental discussion about why the heck we're doing this when we don't have, you know, when our school system is falling apart.
I hear you.
Thank you.
Well, you've asked some good questions.
But are we going to be able to get any answers back, I guess, from maybe we need to go talk to the governor. To see what direction they...
Yeah, and I think that as we have the discussions in the land board over the next year with the development of the Elliott Management Plan and the Habitat Conservation Plan, I think starting with the discussion they'll have next week, you know, I will be able to give you a better idea of where the governor would be coming from on this.
But that still begs the central question here, that if we're going to set aside a whole bunch of the Elliott in order to get a habitat conservation plan out of U.S. Fish and Wildlife or wherever it comes out of, and we diminish the ability to cut timber on that land and get money into the Common School Fund, and we get to a point where, you know, 30% of the harvest revenue goes to cover the expenses of harvesting, why are we doing this?
Senator Messerly, Representative Morgan, one of, and I think one of the dilemmas that we're caught in is that if we don't do a habitat conservation plan, and we only have to adhere to the TAKE guidelines for marbled murrelets, because we can't not adhere to the or not comply with the Federal Endangered Species Act, it's going to be worse over the long term. And that's one of the things that John Buter talks about in his study.
And isn't the Elliott in the fringe area of the murrelet?
That's what I understand.
Have we challenged the Endangered Species Act?
I don't know with regard to that. Don't know.
Senator Morgan, did you have further questions?
Well, I think just to voice my extreme frustration about, you know, doing the same thing that we did with the spotted owl, where we took all thousands and thousands of acres of federal timberland out of the productive harvest base, and we were supposed to save owls, and we apparently haven't been very effective at doing that, but we sure have been effective at destroying our economy. And, you know, here we are walking down the same road.
So noted. Make you feel better.
No.
That's a good point. I think we need to pursue this. Maybe we need to discuss and figure out how to approach it.
But I don't know. I don't know how to, you know, we've been trying, as you know, perhaps I need for years, trying to get to the bottom of the spotted owl. Have not been very successful. continually grows worse.
But I do agree with you, Mr. Chair, that a conversation with the governor on this would be, I think, very instructive, because I think all of us are frustrated that in the legislative arena that have been working on these issues, that without having a governor who's a vocal and actual supporter, it's you can't move ahead on the issues.
We're also running into a very similar situation on the Tillamook Forest, aren't we? Different, set up a little bit differently, and the formula is different. But as far as the communities and the economy, very similar. Would you feel free to go ahead?
Okay, sure.
Now
that
we've
cleared the hearing room.
Right.
This map shows illustrations of the different types of land management activities we get into in terms of generating money for the Common School Fund, ranging from leases with industrial ports, houseboat leases, the marinas. We've had 4 fiber optic cables coming in to Oregon over the last year and a half. The New Carissa shipwreck that occurred and the lawsuit that was there was a ruling on the Elliott State Forest. Range lands, communication leases, and agricultural land, as well as gravel leases.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, Representative Morgan.
I'm back looking at this display in the main budget document, and I'm looking at the revenue and comparing it to the expenses, and I'm wondering, for instance, on waterway leases, that you've got a revenue figure here. Is there an expense figure here somewhere?
Yes. Right. Doesn't show for waterway lease expenses. We can get.
Cindy, do you have that information?
We can get that information.
I think, Mr. Chair, if you would indulge me, it would be interesting for the committee to see the expenses that offset all of these revenue sources.
Mm-hmm. We can try to, it might be hard to allocate it precisely because sometimes you have some positions that deal with some of these, several of these different revenue sources.
What I'm looking at here, for example, is fill removal permits generate $406,000, but they cost $3.2 million.
That's correct, and that's one of the things, right now the permit revenue that comes in covers less than 15% of the cost of the program, and that's one of the reasons why we have submitted a bill in this session to try to increase the percentage that that covers of the program.
Oh.
You can have this one.
We've had this discussion.
But I do. I would be interested in seeing the expense side of these revenue generators if you could get that information to us.
We can do that.
I'm looking at constitutional revenues too. Would it be possible also on the constitutional revenues to get the expense side of that?
Yes, we can do that. We'll try to get that close matched as we possibly can.
Thank you.
Okay. Welcome, Representative. Do you have any questions?
I'll catch up.
In terms of organization for the budget for the Division of State Lands, the Common School Fund programs include the Director's Office, Field Operations, Policy and Planning and Finance and Administration, and then there's a separate budget unit for South Slough National Estuary and the Natural Heritage Advisory Council. The revenues in 2003-05 that are projected are $95.5 million. The largest bulk of that comes from investments, around $60 million. Forestry is it's $26.6 million for forestry. We do get some federal funds in A lot of the federal funds, though, go to the South SLU. And then $6.2 million in rents and royalties, for example, waterway leases and grazing. And then fees, fines, and forfeitures. In terms of expenditures, $34 million of the $51.9 million that's shown there goes out in distributions to schools. The Common School Fund programs, Division of State Lands, $14.6 million. Natural Heritage Advisory Council, $100 million. South SLU, $2 million. And capital improvements, $500,000.
Mr. Chair, could I ask a question?
Yes, Representative Morgan.
The Natural Heritage Advisory Council, talk to us about what that is.
That is, they compile a database of plants and...
And this is the database that's been transferred to the OSU?
That's correct.
Why do you still have the Advisory Council in your department?
Let me have Jeanette come on up here.
Mr. Chair, Representative Morgan, the Advisory Council functions to do other things besides a database. The other part of the Natural Heritage Advisory Program, or the Natural Heritage Program, is to create a Natural Heritage Plan, which looks at places or species of particular interest in this state, unique to this state, and as well as geologic formations. And they register those, just so that we know where they are.
And this is germane to state lands? Or
the registration goes through, they are an advisory council to the land board, and so they make the representation. The reason we didn't try to move the whole thing is because they don't have, OSU doesn't have the same kind of a board-type function that has that administrative ability to register something.
I'm wondering if the function of the board doesn't also take place within other state agencies, like within the Department of Ag and the Department of Forestry and the Department of Fish and Wildlife. Are not these agencies also making recommendations and watching out over endangered species?
Mr. Chair, Representative Morgan, yes, they are. And this entity, the Advisory Council, is not just endangered species. It's plants, animals, and I guess that's somewhat unique. They have plants, they have animals, they have insects, and they have the geologic formations. These are not they're not a regulatory entity. They just show where these spots are in our state that are maybe one of a kind. Or representative of something that's unique about Oregon.
A follow-up?
Thank you.
Or comment?
Is this a statutory?
Yes, it is.
Creation?
Yes.
And what's the funding source? Where's that $100,000 come from?
It's the $100,000 included. Actually, that looks kind of weird. The $100,000. Oh, I know where it is. There's some federal funds that. And that are come in the form of grants for them, and they do research on, for example, one of the things that they do research on is, or they fund research for, butterfly research with the Oregon Zoo, or the Portland Zoo, that on endangered butterflies. But the other part of the money, $30,000 of it now, is general fund money.
Mr. Chair, an editorial comment, if I might?
Yes.
I think, somewhat of a stretch to have this function within the Division of State Lands at this point. I mean, I could see the connection when you had the database over there, because this would be the kind of thing that would be factored into the database. But I would think that if we are looking at ways to, make government work better and more efficiently and cheaper, that this may be one of the things that we want to check for duplications in other departments and possibly push off to the back burner.
You say this advisory council is appointed by the governor?
They're a statutory council. They're created in statute, but they are the members of it are appointed by the governor.
And what is the criteria for that membership?
I don't remember right off the top of my head. Most of them are scientists of some sort. There's also representatives from most of the natural resource agencies who are non-voting members of the council.
How many members are on the council?
There are, I'm thinking there's seven, although this is really off the top of my head, I think there's seven appointed members, and then the members of the state agencies, which are parks, fish and wildlife, forestry, BSL, water.
So let me get a clear picture in my mind. So they are an advisory council, but I thought I heard you say that they do make decisions.
They submit recommendations to the landlord. The landlord actually has to take the action.
And how long have we had this council in effect?
Since 1979. What I'd like to do is bring you a copy of the plan that might help you understand, see better a little bit what they do, as well as a copy of their list of registered sites. Most of the sites are private land, and they're all voluntary. They're not, you know, we don't go out looking for sites to register. These are all voluntary registrations. Some of them are state land, some are private.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Morgan.
So the advisory committee makes recommendations to the land board, and then what does the land board do with the recommendations?
They either register the site or not. I mean, they just accept or reject the recommendation of the.
And by registering it, then it's entered into the database?
By registering it, it's entered into the, it's included in the plan as a site that is representative of a unique, something unique about Oregon, natural heritage site.
I'm interested in a better understanding of how this works and what the impact is, both public and private.
Okay.
I think potentially not all that much money, but what the impact it has on what the landowners can do with their property could be huge. Representative Krieger.
Chair,
you're up to speed.
Excuse me for being late. Well, I left one agency, came to this one, and you're talking about a council. I just got done talking for 3 hours about OPAC, Oregon Policy Advisory Council. Exactly the same thing. They make recommendations. What happens to the recommendations? Are they adopted or not adopted? Of course, they're not mandatory. Well, they are now under OPAC, but how do they act upon them? That's what we're trying to do now. We've got Greg Shamoff looking at how we're going to do it with OPAC, because right now it's not working.
There are, you know, two areas that we interact with a natural heritage natural heritage program. One is that they do maintain a database that if public agencies or even private developers want to find out where there are sensitive species, if they need to consider that, they'll contact the natural heritage program, and they can provide that information that might be in their database.
Well, that comes out of the database at OSU, doesn't
that's
it?
That's right, and that's because it was with the Nature Conservancy. The second part is voluntary registration of significant or notable natural sites, and that's strictly voluntary. And for the 2 years that I've been working with the land board, I think the only ones that we've gotten are ones that have been proposed by the Nature Conservancy.
Well, but if they're voluntary, which I would assume means that whoever owns the land wants them to be registered, then why do they have to go through the advisory committee and the land board? Why don't they just get put in the database?
I think because they're reviewed for any kind of natural significance that they have. That's what the council looks at.
I keep going back to the place where, you know, we've got a choice where we can put these general fund dollars and we can put them in human services, or we can put them in public safety, or we can put them in education, or we can put them in an advisory council that says whether something is worth putting in a database.
I think it's a good point of discussion that we need to put some thought to before we go to work session. We've got to pull this together at some point.
Mr. Chair, we'll get you some information. The council itself has also been struggling with what their role should be now that the database is transferred, how they should relate to that, you know, OSU, and so I think it's a good conversation to have.
Okay. Carry on.
The next part is to focus on how the agency has been performing and what outcomes are going to be expected. We're going to have a greater discussion of the performance measures a little bit later on, but what we wanted to look at here were initiatives that the agency has taken, and then also areas where we've heard that there are major concerns or major issues about the agency, and then how we've tried to address it. And then next, after we're done with this section, next I'll focus on what we're going to be setting priorities on for the next biennium and looking at. In terms of the removal fill program, we've made a number of improvements over this in this current biennium. We've streamlined, we've been working on streamlining the process. The statewide programmatic general permit is nearing completion. We hope to get hope to hear from the services in July over approval of the biological opinion, and that it will be in place then to start at the end of this year or beginning of next year. We've overhauled our rules to improve clarity and make them easier for small projects, as well as we've done jurisdictional changes on irrigation ditches, for example, and removed irrigation ditches where there are no fish from our jurisdiction. In terms of internal, we've reorganized our staff. We've separated out the land management functions and the removal fill permitting functions. They'd all been kind of taken care of under one individual, and we found that the kind of skills that you need for dealing with leases is different than what you need to do with the permitting side. And so I think that's helped out the process. We also felt that we had heard that there was inconsistencies, so we put into place an enforcement manual, and we're also working on an operating procedures manual, and then we'll be posting both of those on our website so people can be clearly seeing the kind of guidance that staff has in putting out the permit. In terms of customer service, over the last year and a half, we've had vacancies, and as we've filled those vacancies, we've filled them with people that have had a real emphasis on problem solving, that have had private sector experience. We've also provided extensive training for staff, the public, and consultants, as well as online now you can look at your permit and see what the status of it is. In addition, we've done a customer survey that we started in 2002, and I can provide you with copies of the results of that customer service survey.
Mr. Chair.
Yes, Representative Johnson.
Thank you. As Director Hannes is passing out the customer survey, I'm just curious what the sample is, whether you sample in doing customer surveys across all of the issues in your portfolio, or do you pinpoint one issue versus another? How do you get your sample?
In this case, this was involved with the removal fill permitting process, and so whenever there's a permit that's applied for, we provide them with a survey where we ask them basically how we're doing from a customer service standpoint.
Do you follow up, Mr. Chair?
Yes.
Do you do this across all parts of your agency?
We do it on waterway leasing too.
Cool. Thanks.
But this, and I'll get into this survey in just a little bit, because that also talks about, I think, areas where we've done well and areas where I think we have some improvement that needs to be done. Or, well, I guess it's Actually, as long as you're looking at it now, how about if I talk a little bit more about it now? I think when I look at this survey, I think some of the areas that I think we need some improvement on are trying to...
And are you looking at the big book now, too?
No, I'm looking at what you have before you, the survey. I just have it in my book under another tab. I think some of the areas where we need some improvement are trying to have clearer instructions in filling out the forms, as well as what our requirements are, as well as timeliness for permit decisions. Now, this survey was done in 2002, and Senate Bill 529, which put definite deadlines on when we have to make decisions on whether a permit is complete, the application is complete, and then a decision was instituted in July of 2002. So we don't have some of the changes that we've done for tightening up the decision making that happened until about halfway through it. But nevertheless, I think we still need to look for ways that we can shave some days off of the decision making process and trying to improve that completeness so that we can get those done and turned around quicker. I think on the other hand, we got good marks for getting to the right person, knowing who to talk to, responding back when people have questions in a timely way, courteousness, and clearly answering questions.
And how many permits did you process in 2002?
I think roughly we've been processing for all permits and general authorizations between 800 and 1,000.
And is that completed permits or is that applications?
That's completed.
So how many applications do you have per year?
Do you know how many applications total
are?
Let me see. Steve's looking for that. I don't have the information of how many applications as opposed to what we actually...
It strikes me that out of 800 permits, only 37 return the questionnaire.
Right. And one of the things that we're going to need to look at in the next biennium, kind of jumping ahead on me, is we need to explore some ways that, one, we can get more input, because this is a very low return rate on the total number that we get. We need to look at whether or not we follow up with maybe some telephone surveys so we do some more scientific sampling and any other methods that we can to increase the return.
Mr. Chair, can I follow up? Can you talk to us about how you distributed this? I mean, how did you get this out, and how did 37 of them come back?
They're a survey form that's attached to the application, and so people can send them back to us.
So they send them in with their application?
They can send them in with their application, or they can send them later. And so what this is a compilation of what we've gotten back. And I really would like to be able to see if we can do some more follow-up in the next biennium of doing a scientific sample so that we can try to get at not only those that just sent it back, but also a whole cross-section of our permit applications.
So can you tie the survey to the applicant when you get them back?
I think only there's one part where it says if people want to put their names down and for us to call them back. Because in some circumstances we ask them, do you want the supervisor to call you to discuss your permit? And so they can do that on this form.
I'm concerned. I think
it's optional.
Mr. Chair,
so
if I could comment.
Well, let me first say that judging from the number of phone calls I get with this study, you get very high marks on the survey.
We're missing the mark here someplace and getting a true picture of what's going on out in the countryside.
And I think we have some work to do. I don't think we're there yet in terms of where we want to be for customer service. This is, I think, one start in trying to have a gauge of how we're doing, but it doesn't capture if somebody doesn't want to return the form to us or they don't want to let us know if they have issues. Certainly, we'd like to try to find a more comprehensive way to understand truly what's going on and whether or not we're hitting the mark or we're not, and where we need to do improvements.
Representative Morgan?
Well, I would submit that your problem is that people just aren't responding, and that part of the problem there might be that I would very much hesitate to send in a survey that criticized your processes along with my application, because I think I would really blunder to my application.
Senator Messer, Representative Martin, people don't need to return it with their application. They can return it separately. And it's optional on here whether or not people want to put their name or not.
And I would concur that, if you put out somewhere between 800 to 1,000, or you get back 800 to 1,000 applications, and only 37 of those people chose to send your survey back in, you got some, there needs to be some kind of work done on what the problem is here.
Senator Messer, Representative Moore, I don't disagree, and that's one of the things that we need to work on in the next biennium, and to make sure that we're trying to figure out some ways to get a higher return and to try to have some other tools to measure how we're doing.
What kinds of discussions are you having in your department about how to work with this?
We're going to be having training in April and May, more intensive training on customer service for our staff, and that's going to be across the board in our staff. Look at ways that wanted to give staff some better suggestions and ways in which we expect for them to work with customers, as well as provide initiatives to improve customer service.
No. Any other questions before we move on? Go ahead.
In terms of the renewal bill,
excuse me, and I do have one question. I want to clarify on question 3 about the time frames to obtain a permit. What is the range of the 800 or so permits that you process? How long it takes, average, and could you group those so we can see how the full extent of the range, how many complaints are taken care of?
You can do that. I can also give you the average that it takes for processing. Under Senate Bill 529, we have 40 days in which to make our completeness determination, and then 90 days to make the decision on the application itself. We're averaging 25 days for the completeness and around 75 days for the decision. So we're within the timeline, but I want to see if there's some ways we can even improve that further.
Explain what you mean by completeness. That means within 25 days, all the applicants, the application is complete?
Right, that it has all the components necessary for us to make a decision and that necessary for that application.
And so you get 100% of those, the application is complete within 25 days, is that what I'm hearing?
Senator Messer, no, what I'm saying is that that's an average.
Okay. And so that range would be...
Yes.
Important to
know. I'm going to ask Steve to talk about that a little bit more.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Steve Purchase, Assistant Director for Field Operation. What Ann is talking about is when you submit an application to us, we have 40 days under Senate Bill 529 to review and tell you whether or not you have a complete application. That initial review includes all the elements that we feel necessary to make the decision without going through the public review process, because that's the part that takes a little bit longer. So we go through your application, make sure that, you know, you've signed it, that you've identified all adjacent landowners, you have a mitigation plan, you've done your minimization, you've done your avoidance, and all those things that we spelled out in rule that we need to know to make the decision. The average time it takes us to review that is 25 days, which is a lot better than we thought we were going to be able to perform. But the reason that we have been successful is because we also spelled out in the rule, and all of our workshops with the public have laid out exactly what you must have to get your application through. So that's one of the improvements that we feel pretty good about.
And if they don't meet the timeline, then what?
If they don't meet the timeline, if we don't meet the timeline, we have not yet met the timeline.
Or if the applicant doesn't meet. You said there's a maximum time that they have to get all the information in?
No, we have the timeline, not them. If you submit your application to us and we go through the review process and we send back to you that your application is incomplete, along with that is a checklist of all the things that you need to submit to us to get your application deemed complete. There's no deadline on the part of the applicant to respond back to us. We just simply hold it.
So it would be interesting how many of those people drop off at that point, or how long it takes them to, once you've notified them exactly what they have to complete, how long it takes them to actually complete the application.
We could do that with a little bit of work to come up with the number, but I can tell you what we do track in our computer system is what we refer to as dormant time. Dormant time is time waiting for an application to come back. Or one of the unique things about Senate Bill 529 that we struggle with the most is that we cannot do the public review process until we get the fee. So sometimes we'll send back the application, deem it complete, and sit and wait for them to pay the fee so we can start the public review process. And we have lots of those where, unfortunately, and we keep reminding them, you need to pay the fee so we can get the public review process done. But, overall, right now it's 71 days to complete your permit process, which is quite a significant increase in change for us.
And where I'm going is I suspect that the process, I mean, we made great improvement, don't get me wrong, but I suspect that there's still a very difficult process to get through. And I guess let me ask you this way. Are you seeing more and more applications being processed by hiring consultants? Or are you seeing a higher percentage of the applications come through put together by consultants?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, it's basically a 50-50 split right now. About 50% of all the projects that come in with consultants. Certainly any of the compensatory well and mitigation projects have consultants associated with those permit requirements, because there's a lot of a layer of complexity there just for that portion. Soil water conservation districts, watershed councils are certainly doing them without consultants.
Is that percentage increasing, or have you seen much change in that over the last 5 years?
Senator Mesley, members of the committee, I'd have to go check that to give you an accurate number. I can do that for you.
Senator Morgan?
What I hear most from the folks in my district are about applications that get kicked back for lack of information. And I'm curious if you have any kind of information about the relationship between the number of applications that you receive and then the number that get processed because they're correctly done, and the number that get kicked back to the applicants because they need more information. And then I think it would be interesting if there was some kind of a survey on those applications to find out why they didn't complete them. Was it they didn't understand the process, or they just didn't feel like putting the information in? I mean, why is it that there is that loop where people don't correctly complete the applications in the first place? And then of the ones that do have to go back, once you get them back, is it common to have to send them out again, or do most of them, after they come back, do they go to the end of the process? I'm just trying to get my hands around why I'm getting all these complaints in my district.
Mr. Chair, Representative Morgan, let me see if I can try to clear up some of the confusion. When Senate Bill 529 went into effect in July of last year, and which required us to do the complete application process, the rules, the rest of the rules that clear up what constitutes a complete application and all the information, the training that we did as a result of that, did not occur until January, because we had to go through rulemaking. The rulemaking was not adopted at the same time that the statute came into place. Even though we did take the rules in front of the board, there was significant concerns raised in the public rulemaking that we wanted to address as well. So when we initiated the entire set of rules, including that complete application criteria, thoroughly spelled out, the very first thing we did is we held two trainings with consultants. And one of the things that we found very quickly was some of them got it right away, some of them had more difficult with that. And as we are starting through the process, we're on our second month, really the second month of getting this initiated. The number of applications, complete applications that we're receiving in, is going up because people are getting used to the system. They know what we expect. We have spelled it out for them. We've held 15 different public meetings on training. We just did a training session at the Society of Wetland Scientists with 75 consultants in the room, where we went down line item by line item. This is what we're looking for. These are the kind of maps we want. I mean, very detailed, complete application criteria. So a consultant or a soil and water conservation district or a watershed group could clearly understand what exactly we're looking for, and then, you know, what the public would see when they get the review process. So we're certainly on the rise up as far as the complete applications. Another question you asked was how quick do we turn them around the second time? I could go look for you, but I believe we're trying to get that done within the next 4 or 5 days. Because we have the complete application ourselves, and we have told you what's missing, so all we got to do is check that off now.
Mm-hmm.
So you don't go all the way back through a review process if you're only missing two or three items.
Another follow-up.
Hello?
Once you are getting the professionals trained and the Watershed Council coordinators trained, then what about people that want to come in the system without a professional? How would they get trained?
Mr. Chair, Representative Morgan, we have initiated that as well. If we have what we have determined as a pre-application meeting. And for the first time, we actually put in our administrative rules an encouragement for people to do pre-application meetings. And if you're a private citizen who wants to get a permit, we will sit down with you and try to explain how to fill out the application. You know, we're not the consultants, and we don't act like consultants. We're just simply the administrators of the program. So we're not consulting for you, but we are helping you through that process. So you can understand that if you have a small project, in our rules we've made that easier now because you don't have to go through minimization avoidance and compensatory mitigation for small projects under 0.2 of an acre, under 250 cubic yards. We try to do some of those things to make it a lot easier for that individual applicant who doesn't want to hire a consultant, nor do we feel they should have to. So we're trying to do more of that outreach all the time. Each of my coordinators that has a geographical territory assigned to them is also required to go out and do 3 times a year a public presentation on the rules and helping people through the process. So we're trying to do a lot more outreach than we've ever done before trying to address that issue.
Steve, when you do your training sessions with consultants and private landowners, first of all, I guess first question is what kind of feedback you're getting from the professionals, and how do you tabulate that kind of feedback? I'm sure that they have suggestions to you as to why you're doing it this way, that, you know, it's information that we could cover much easier. If you're getting that kind of feedback, or is it a two-way interchange, or are you simply telling them how the program is operating now?
Senator Measley, we are getting feedback back. We went through a 3-year public rulemaking process on removal fill program because it basically was a re-engineering of the program, and we did receive extensive comments from the consultants. We are still receiving those same comments, both through a couple of bills that are working its way through the state legislature right now. John Lilly is heading up a work group with one of the bills where we have, I believe, 3 consultants on the team that are trying to put together some streamlined process for that to happen as well. One of the things we're also doing, much like we did at last Friday's meeting at the Society of Wetland Scientists, we actually sat down and took notes of what they would like to recommend to us and what we ought to try to fix. So we are constantly taking that feedback, trying to make that system work better. But, you know, we do have professional disagreements between professional people, and consultants have, you know, what their view of it is, and we have our view, and we try to work together to get a common view, but sometimes we find ourselves in conflict with each other, and it seems to be the nature of the beast.
Let me ask you, do you get a different response from consultants than you do from private landowners?
Senator Measley, yes, we do. Consultants are usually much better versed either on the process or one of the criteria, particularly on a wetland mitigation or a particular soil type or something like that. They're much more experts in that and better versed than a private citizen or someone else might be, or even a watershed council member. So we certainly see a lot different kind of response back from a consultant.
Okay. Any other questions, committee? All right.
I think we talked about the 529 deadlines a bit. Industrial land pilot project, this is one that we're working in Sutherland as well as Lebanon. We have an MOU that we've signed with the local government or with the entities there. We're looking at that's going to be on track to be completed this July. It's going to be one where we're trying to provide all the pre-application work done up front so we can provide assurance where can be developed down there. And I do believe that there will be clarity in terms of where development can take place. So we're hopeful with that project is going to help address some of the concerns in terms of industrial lands and trying to find a way through so it can not only help with economic development but also meet the requirements of the remove and fill law. Steve talked about we've had more frequent communication with environmental consultants. And also, we've put in place an ODOT agreement with ODOT, a partnership for trying to have quicker response to their projects, as well as we're just going to be opening, we've opened up rulemaking so that we can put in place a general authorization for bridge projects and pilings. That's essentially a much more expedited, quicker process than the regular permit process. And that'll be available for both public and private.
And where are you trying to go with this?
And I know what you're trying to do with the commercial industrial sites is get pre-approval so that when a buyer or a developer comes in, they can move much faster through the process. But are we going to be able to do the same thing with small business, some of the natural resource type property owners as well as small business, to where they can get some understanding or some have some security that where they're going is not going to get held up for long periods of time. In other words, I think what I'm trying to say is that we need pre-approval for all types of property ownership. Some of them we're not going to make. You understand that? But if it complies with the land use that's in place, are we going to be able to get pre-approval on those properties too?
Senator Miserly, I think that's why we greatly encourage trying to come and talk with us beforehand so that you can have a good idea of what you can and can't do so you can be able to plan your project and figure out what you want to do. The other thing that we did in our rules was to try to help out smaller projects so that if you have a project that involves 2/10 of an acre or I think 250 cubic yards or less, you don't have to go through the detailed process. We've streamlined and gotten rid of some of the requirements and made it easier for people with very small projects. In terms of trust property, we conducted an internal review and then we asked the Secretary of State to audit trust properties, and we've got a list of about 50 recommendations, of which we've implemented most of that, some of which we need in our budget now in order to complete those recommendations. But we've done all that we can within existing resources. We've put in place written procedures for the first time for estates. We've done staff cross-training and updated the rules. We've put out new contracts for the stockbroker that was handling the stocks and mutual funds that we got in, as well as we're working now for getting a new contract for an auctioneer. And also we've set up an advisory committee that includes businesses and members that are interested in unclaimed property. You can work with them through some of the issues.
Mr. Chair.
Yes, Representative Thompson.
Was the 50-item work plan the result of the audit? I mean, the thing I'm trying to get clear, you just said that it was, but what I'm trying to understand is, were there 50 items in the audit that the Secretary of State said needed improvement as a result of the audit, or did that plan grow organically just from some of the things that...
Senator Mesley, Representative Johnson, that 50 items includes not only what was recommended in the audit, and that audit is in your budget book here that you can read, as well as what we identified internally that needed to be done. So we put together a an internal audit response team that Jeanette Hallman was responsible for, and included the trust property manager and Cindy Wickham, as well as our communications, Monty Turner. And then we went through and looked at what can we do internally, how can we shift the way in which staff is operating, how can we, and what can we do in terms of physically the structure. For example, there was a outside door that wasn't within our locked door area internally. We closed off that, walled off that door, and made the door only to get in through trust property. We've made lock combination changes to the vaults. We've instituted procedures, written procedures. So it's a whole combination of things to try to make sure that we follow sound fiduciary management and have dual custody of the items that we're dealing with.
One follow-up. I guess what I'm trying to get a handle on is that you indicated earlier that there were different procedures that could be in place to make sure that you maximize the auction receipts, and then you end up getting a 50-item work plan for dealing with the trust properties, and yet it seems as though, in some respects, business is continuing as usual while you're working through these issues, and I'm looking for some reassurance I haven't read the audit, so I'm at the disadvantage there, but if the audit generated that many issues, at what point does that become a crisis and work as normal ceases and you deal with the issues that have to do with custody and control? Or I'm just trying to get a sense for how severe this audit was in terms of generating a 50-item work plan.
Senator Mesley, Representative Johnson, it was a real challenge, I think, over the last year and a half to put in place the recommendations as well as, you know, continue the day-to-day processing. Some of the things we could do immediately, for example, one of the things that we needed to change controls on who had access to what parts of the computer database. And so, you know, some of that we could institute right away, or making sure that one person didn't have the full combination to the vault. So we divided between, you know, two different staff. One has half the combination, the other has the other half the combination. In cross-training staff, we'd rotate who was helping out in the vault, because when you open up the packages from the safety deposit contents, you need to have two people there logging it in, you know, so one, you know, you have two people checking it and logging it at the same time for security reasons. So, yeah, it was a challenge, but we put in place. What I'm really proud of my staff is that they rose up to the challenge and put this in place, and it was a major change from how they had been doing business.
One last question. How long between this audit that appears to be the most recent one that's dated this December 28th of 2001, how long a period had elapsed between this audit and any previous audit, assuming there was one?
Jeanette, I don't know when the last audit we had was property.
Mr. Chair, Representative Johnson, my understanding is that there had been an audit in the early 90s of some of these cross controls that was not done by the Secretary of State. It was done by a You guys know? It was done by, I believe it was a fiscal manager or fiscal officer from another agency. It was not done by the Secretary of State's office, per se. I believe that's the last one prior to this audit.
Thank you.
Have you compared the findings of that audit with the findings of this audit? And was there a repeat?
Mr. Chair, I believe there were some things that had not been completely taken care of in that first audit. There were a number of staff changes at DSL between that early 90s and in some of the things were implemented, but some of them were not implemented to the degree that they are now as far as some of the process changes. And frankly, it was in part, you know, we're asking for some staff, and we asked for some staff last session that we to continue. And the dual custody is a challenge, and I think that's probably where the weakest part of the earlier recommendations were, because always having two people available to do all the steps or to separate duties is sometimes difficult.
It gets hard, for example, where we have an estate, somebody dies, you've got to go out to the property, the house, and secure it as well as inventory what's there. You've got to send two people out to that house, you know, for not only for the dual custody, but also for security reasons, because we get a whole range of different situations we deal with.
Of the 50 items, how many of them are you in compliance with now? Okay. Or have you resolved? I guess that's better.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I was the author of the 50 items, and let me explain a little bit about where they came from. In conversations and in some of the earlier reports of the audit, you know, their preliminary drafts had more detail than what you see in front of you. We pulled from that. We also broke a number of those suggestions down into smaller parts, manageable bites. I believe that we have complied with between 90 to 95% of those items. We have not completely rewritten all of our procedures for the trust property program. We have them for the estates. We're still working on the you know, consolidating all the everybody's notes about how they're supposed to be doing their job for the rest of the program as far as to get a desk manual. And some of the items we're still kind of watching our budget to see. For example, one of the things they recommended is that we actually purchase safes for our vault, because our vault has an unsecured ceiling. And so they recommended...
You can't get it through the walls.
You can come into the ceiling. So they recommended that we get actually have some safes installed inside the vault. We're watching our budget, and I think we're going to be able to purchase some of those.
So when you develop your 50-item list, do you then work back to the auditors to see if this is going to meet their needs or their concerns?
Yes, and they have been, they should be coming around to check how we're doing. I believe they said sometime this year. But we've also called them when we have questions about, is this what you think, will this meet what you suggested in your audit? And they've been very good about saying, yeah, that meets our needs.
And also when the auditors were doing their audit, when an issue arose, for example, on the computer security, we didn't wait until they published their final report. They told us, and then we did it.
Could you supply us with the list of what you've done and also what you've got yet to do?
Yes, we can.
I thought that there was in here the latest response, although I think that was as a... if you look under tab number 10 of the agency budget, it shows up here our response to Secretary of State audit and what we've done, but I think this is the actual list of
no,
all
I have a little
items.
Table that I have that I can... Okay. I may have to translate some of my scribbles.
I have a question for Representative Johnson, and then it's time.
I'll be very eager to see the list, only because one of the things you said was you don't have a desk manual. So if you don't have it sort of codified what people are supposed to do, how can they be in compliance, period? I mean, they don't know what the rules are and they're not written down. I don't know how you can expect people to be able to faithfully discharge the recommendations from the audit.
Mr. Chair, Representative Johnson, they have their notes from when they were trained. They have manuals for how to run our unclaimed property system, computer system. What they don't have is all of this put in one place. And that's exactly right. They have to have their procedures written down.
It should be office or division policy.
Absolutely.
We're out of time. I'm going to close the public hearing and adjourn the meeting.